Radio Today programme with Broadcast Bionics. Innovative solutions for creative radio people.
It is the weekly podcast from Radio Today. Thanks for downloading. I'm Stuart Clarkson, in for Trevor Down this week. And you join us in the salubrious surroundings of the BBC in Salford. We're at Radio Manchester today to talk to a legend who has just marked 35 years on air. And he's here in front of us, and he's looking as fit as he did 35 years ago. Mr. Mike Sweeney, welcome to the show.
Great to be here.
Now, Mike, 35 years ago, you were in a rock and roll band. How did you wind up on the radio?
Through the summer of 1980, the Salford Jets, the band that was in, started to have, probably that was our peak of success. We had a song out called Gina, I've Got a Cortina, which made top 100 just, but got into the top 5 of the Piccadilly chart, which was quite a big deal. Piccadilly Radio at the time had, don't know, a million listeners maybe. And we did a concert for Piccadilly Radio at the Willows in Salford on the rugby ground. And they asked me to come in and A, do a promo for it, and B, do an interview. I think it was with Tom Tyrrell. So I did the promo, and I did something unscripted. They said, well, here's your script. I said, oh, no, let me just ad-lib it. So I ad-libbed something, and I made a disparaging comment about Pat on reception, about if you can get past them two posers on reception, blah, blah, blah. So I made this comment and then went and did the interview. And Tony Ingham, who was at that time station, what we now call programme controller, I think it was probably called the station manager, said to Colin Walters, this was in the days when the radio station was actually owned by people, said to Colin Walters, the MD, he said, it's got a really unusual voice, Mike Sweeney. You know, it's there's something about it that's very different. So the two of them then came to watch me and the Jets gigging. And I remember at the time having just thinking, oh, there's Tony Ingham, Colin Walters from Piccadilly Radio, or Piccadilly 261 as it was known. And they listened to me. And when I was doing the Jets, we were sort of what you would now call a punk band, but I don't know, like a new wave Brit poppy thing. But I was forever rabbiting on in between songs because it just seemed to fit what we were doing, and I was irreverent and cheeky and a bit rude sometimes. And Colin and Tony said, his stuff in between the songs is really, it's quite funny, isn't it? And Tony Ingham said, I think we could maybe put this guy on the air. Now, you got to remember that at that time, there wasn't a single local accent anywhere on either local radio or the BBC. Although maybe Billy Butler in Merseyside was an obvious Scouser. And I suppose John Peel had a bit of an accent that you could tell. But really, it was all high. Even on Radio 1, it was high. And on commercial radio, it was sensational.
So, but yeah, you got the Piccadilly Radio, massive in Manchester, been going 6 years, but no local voices, like you say.
Even the guys that were local, they talk like that. And they make colleagues, I love them, but none of them had an accent. So they tried me out. The first thing they tried me out doing, well, I did a demo for them, and they actually put it out. And I was probably a bit drunk. Me and Steve Huckvale, who was producing, well, I brought a crate of Newcastle Brown in, and we drank a lot of it. And I've listened back since, and you can actually tell that I'm drunk. Now, normally that would be your career finished. And they found it, the lads thought it was hilarious, and they actually transmitted it. Then they said, look, we'll try you out once a week. I'll tell you what, next week, do the top 10. So I went into the studio to do the top 10 and couldn't operate, so I had an operator. And the first record I played was My Old Piano by Diana Ross, and I didn't like it, so I took it off the turntable. I wasn't drunk this time, but I was full of adrenaline and all sorts of stuff and testosterone, and some workman had been in, and there was a hammer, so I smashed the record up with a hammer, and I think I put the Sex Pistols Pretty Vacant on, which became a theme tune for a few years. So the next week they had all these when people used to write to radio stations, there's this last massive mailbag, and they said, you can't do that. That Mike Sweeney that you put on only played 3 records because he said he didn't like any of the others and played stuff from his record collection. And he smashed them up with a hammer. Well, again, Colin and Tony thought this was very funny indeed. But they said, look, we'll put you on in the evening. So it was Thursday evening they put me on. I think it was something like 10 till midnight. First day I was on, I said, look, it's a bit boring getting letters. Could you write to me for requests on anything but paper? And the next day, And I mean, the next day they had a tyre, a brick, a car bonnet, a newspaper boy's bag. All this stuff came in, cardboard boxes. And I remember saying, well, I won't allow cardboard boxes because it's paper, that. But the only thing we've not had is a kitchen sink. And then the next day we got a kitchen sink with a request written on it. Poor old Pat on reception by this time is going absolutely doolally, trying to move this stuff out. So it was the middle of October, doing these ad hoc programmes. So programme each week. So we got to Christmas and I've probably done about 10 of these programmes. And it was midnight on the final Thursday before Christmas. I'm leaving. And it was literally week to week, not even really a month. Well, sort of a month, but we'll try week to week. Tony Ingham was walking towards me down the corridor, and I remember sort of thinking it was a bit unusual that the boss would be in at midnight. And he said, "Have you got a minute?" And I thought, aye, they're going to give me the push. So I went to the office, said, "How do you think you're doing?" Of course, typical Sweeney. I mean, I'm confrontational now and I'm 68. Well, at 33... I said, well, I think I'll paraphrase this for radio. I think I've done flipping well. And Tony said, yep, so do we. He said, how would you like to go on the air after the Christmas holidays and do Monday to Friday? I think it was 1 till 3. And I said, okay. And Tony reiterated this story because he was on my programme on the 35th anniversary. I apparently, and I do remember vaguely saying, but what about the band? You know, will it affect the band? Tony said, I had a box with about 200 cassettes in for would-be DJs, and I'm having to try and persuade this guy to earn, and literally went and increased my income fivefold. I went from earning 50 quid a week for doing 42 hours, driving a van, and being in a band full-time at the night, to earning 250 quid a week for doing 10 hours. And he's trying to persuade me. Anyway, he did persuade me to sign the contract. And 35 years on Friday just gone was when I signed the contract to do a show every day. And combination of good luck and fortune, for 35 years, I've managed to present a daily radio programme, apart from when I've either been ill or deliberately took like a sabbatical, like I did at various job changes, including the one time that a guy called Mike Briscoe wanted to sack me at Piccadilly Radio. And Colin said, you can't really sack him, Mike. He's part of the DNA. And he said, well, I want to do something. So he got rid of me off my daily programme. And on the day he told me that, and there's a story around how miffed I was, I got a phone call from Pennine from a guy called Will Ventner. This is ridiculous. He said, that Mike Sweeney? I said, yeah. He said, how would you like to do our breakfast programme? And I went, really? He went, yeah. I went, you've got me. So I went, on the one time I got sacked, well, sidelined, I ended up doing a couple of programmes a week, I got a job the same day. And I've never been asked quite like that ever.
Yeah.
So there we are.
Let's just go wind back a little bit, because you obviously started in radio quite late. It wasn't something you ever really thought of as a career, anything you wanted to do. Did you listen to the radio before that? You'd obviously listen to Piccadilly and stuff. But
no, I was a radio fan.
Yeah.
Not an anorak. I had no intention. I didn't want to be a DJ ever.
But you'd remember the Pirates and Radio 1. And
Pirates, Radio Luxembourg. But I remember listening to the BBC when it was like programmes like, you know, Teenagers Turn, and you would have to listen to the BBC all week. And if you were very lucky, you'd get, you know, you might get 20 pop songs in a week.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it was full of orchestras and, you know, stuff my mum and dad liked. But Radio 1 was the groundbreaker.
I mean, you'd be what, 20 when that launched? So,
exactly 20. It launched in 67. I think the first track was Flowers in the Rain, and
but that was quite poptastic with the Tony Blackburn and stuff. But there was Peel on there and Kenny Everett.
We knew no better. As far as I was concerned, all DJs had to be poptastic. That was how you did.
Yeah.
That's why I never wanted to be a DJ. I wasn't poptastic at all. I was a scruff from Salford. And quite rumbustious and a bit leery. I've never been cool. So all these guys, but I actually thought they were quite cool. It's just that I could never be like that. So from Radio 1 then, I mean, the one DJ that I admired tremendously at that time was John Peel, who I did think was different than anybody else, and continued my relationship with his programme. And I've got to say, it's so much time for Mike Reed and Kid Jensen. Funnily enough, the two Radio 1 DJs that got behind the Salford Jets in 78, 79 and 80 and 81.
Obviously, you were going on the radio with the Jets, as you mentioned. Do you remember the first time you walked into a radio studio?
Yes. Phil Sayer had got this record, and it was our first record. It's actually called Looking at the Squares, but it's only got one line in it, and the line is walking around the town, town, looking at the squares, walking around the town, town, looking at the squares. Very punky in a way.
Yeah.
And Phil got this record, saw it was by a band called The Salford Jets, and thought, and no promo, nothing, no biography with it, just sent in the post from the record company. And he thought, they've got to be from Salford. That's weird in itself. Nobody would call themselves that. Then he played it and he freaked out. And he played it again in the same, when you could do that sort of thing, played it again in the same programme and managed to get hold of me to come in and explain what it was about. So I came in wide-eyed into Piccadilly, sat in that little central bit where there's like a curvy settee thing, waiting to be summoned into the studio. And it was funny because I didn't know the protocol. So when he'd finished the interview, which only lasted like 4 or 5 minutes, it was great. I just thought I was going to sit there for the rest of the programme. He had to ask me to go. I said, well, you're done now, Mike. And I thought, all right, great. No, I don't have anybody sat in the studio. Oh, sorry, right. And, you know, I just thought I was going to sit there and talk to him for the next 2 hours. So that's the first time I ever came in a studio. Then after that, we were on radio quite a lot, and we were on Radio 1 a lot in 79, 80 and 81. She's Gonna Break Your Heart was a big A-list song. So I was going in on Reedy's programme and doing David Jensen sessions. The only person we didn't do sessions for was John Peel. I think John thought we were a bit basic, bit too conventional for John Peel in a way, a bit too conventional rock and roll. But the BBC Radio 1, I was on loads, and of course I was on Piccadilly Radio all the time and on national TV with the Jets in 79 and 80. We probably did 4 or 5 or 6 national TV programmes.
So then you kind of gave up the drive in the van and turned into this disc jockey working every day on Piccadilly Radio. And through the 80s, Piccadilly got even bigger because you had people like Timmy Mallett there, and you had people like Penk eventually.
Chris Evans.
Yep. A lot of stars coming through there.
Yeah.
Were you ever, and you still stood out as being this kind of local Salford voice. Did anybody ever try to kind of mould you and shape you and make you sound like a DJ?
Not at all. Colin and Tony, who ran it pretty much for the years when what I was doing, because what I did stayed revolutionary probably for a good time. And I didn't realise what I was doing at the time, but it stayed very, very dynamic for a good 2 or 3 or 4 years. Obviously, after you've been on 4 or 5 or 6 years, they're used to you. But they were massively supportive. I was never, ever, ever given any restrictions whatsoever. Don't think I let them down. Don't ever remember getting any serious trouble. Radio 1 came in and had a look at me. Colin sent them a really sniffy letter because Doreen Davies came down from Radio 1 and had a chat to me. But I think for Radio 1, whereas now accents are almost compulsory, I was a little bit too much. I think it might have been Johnny Beerling that was running the station. 2 or 3 people. If it was not Johnny, I do apologise, but if it was... They said, you've got to put this guy on Radio 1. He's pulling trees up. And the Rage Act was called Jikrar in those days. Mm-hmm. My figures for that programme increased, I think Ray Terrett had it before me, increased something like 300-fold in months. It was that dramatic, the rise, that it registered on one Jikrar. It was that huge. And by 81 and into 82, figures for that programme were bigger than any programme on the radio, bigger than the breakfast programme. So they took this tapes of me. And apparently, if it was Johnny Beale, he said, over my dead body, the day we have anything like that on Radio 1, the day we do will be over my dead body.
If it was early 80s, it might have been Derek Chinnery, I think.
Well, whoever it was, Johnny, and I know that for a fact, because there was one particular producer took me in and said, oh, this is it, this is the future. Not for Radio 1, it wasn't.
I mean, you stayed, obviously, at Piccadilly till the late 90s, and radio changed a bit as we got into
it changed
late 80s, early 90s, a bit more corporate, a bit more formatted. but you still stayed there. You obviously went on to Piccadilly Gold.
I did.
Did you feel like you were being told what to do a bit more?
No, I did feel it was very obvious, though, from day one, that the Gold format, which, by the way, still had lots of life in it, but it was obvious from that day to me that it was slightly second best as far as the corporate entity that ran the station.
They put the effort and the resource into Q103 instead.
We weren't quite the ginger-haired stepchild that we became in Gold as the years went on. And I was still, had great success there and still doing. I remember when Steve Penk and I were doing breakfast, he was doing it on FM and I was doing it on AM, and he had about 550,000-600,000 plus listeners, and I had 300 odd, nearly 400,000. So between us, we still had 1 million listeners. But I was aware that, and if I'm being brutally honest now, with the benefit of hindsight, maybe when they said, and of course we'd put you on Gold, you know, should I have said no thanks? I want to go on Q103, but I didn't because I didn't know enough, to be honest.
Mm. And that Gold format then stuck with you, because as you eventually left what was Piccadilly, you'd shown up on
Capital Radio.
Yeah.
On Capital Gold. But that was, at that time, on that station, massive. Absolutely a massive job to do. And I remember asking some very, very good friends, I won't embarrass them, some of them are still very prominent in radio, who cared about me and who I know were decent, and I said, am I doing the right thing going to Capital Radio? And everybody said, no, Mike, it won't work. It really won't work. The people that did believe were Richard Park, who gave me the job, who asked me to come, Andy Turner, who was my boss there, Steve Penk, who opened the door for me, and Simon Cole, funnily enough, at Unique, thought that I had a chance, and it worked from day one. And it was massive. And by the time I moved on from that, it was as if London was behind the rest of the country. As Gold got tired and tired in a programming way, and it was always on AM,
yeah,
and there was never any resources, and it shrunk, and they started having people taping programmes and voice tracking and then just playing records, say, through the night. As that happened, London was insulated a bit. So it was still, when I left Gold to go to Real Access, it had only just started to sag a little bit by that time.
And then, as you say, you mentioned, well, Rock Radio, as it was 2008, you were probably the first name down on the team sheet for that, were you? Manchester Rock Station,
right.
We Need Sweeney.
And here's the story behind that. It's the only time I've ever asked for a job. John Myers, it was John Myers' baby. John was doing a programme across from me, and I went in, I said, can I have a word with you after the programme? They just got the franchise, and it was going to be called Rock Talk.
Yeah.
And I said, John, I've never done this before, but it's a talking rock station in Manchester. Please give me a job on it. And he went, we will. However, I'm not certain that I would have been first on the sheet if I hadn't actually, if you're pardon the colloquialism, mithered John. Although maybe I would have done. But what a move that was. We moved there. It was amazing. The only problem was, about an hour after we launched, the recession hit. And that station wouldn't have gone on air if they'd have come up with the concept 6 months later. It wouldn't have gone on air.
But it was a lot of speech. It was, what, 40% speech in your drive time show or something like that?
It was, easy.
Yeah.
I think the station as a whole had to have something like 50% or 52% speech, obviously. But they counted news, weather, traffic and travel, features, all in that. Interviews, all counted in that. But yet, even on drive, I was on 40%. Breakfast was on 52%.
But it worked, and it got listeners, and it was a station with attitude, I
suppose.
It was. And that was quite different at that time to all the other corporate stuff.
And with that initial team that were there, that was me, Moose, who ran it, and Rach, J-Rock, Digitom, Dewsbury, the Kurtmanator, Steve Berry, all of us in that first team. And I remember, and keep in touch, you know, with all of them,
yeah,
and Carnage, all of them, we were, for a while, genuine rock and roll radio. It wasn't put on. I remember Moose doing a programme drunk one day because he'd been out the night before and hadn't sobered up. It was hilarious because he was sober enough to do the programme, but it was obvious he was a bit drunk. And I remember me and Dewsbury, every Christmas Eve, when by this time we were on breakfast, we did bourbon and bacon breakfast, and we brought a bottle of Jack Daniels in, bacon butties, and saw how the programme changed from 6 o'clock till 10. Can you imagine doing that on radio? And the boss is thinking it was just the best idea in the world.
There's an idea for tomorrow morning here at BBC Manchester.
Possibly the BBC might not be the right environment.
Rock and roll star, rock and roll radio star. How did you wind up in BBC local radio, which some people see as kind of comfy slippers radio, but it's not.
And without being disrespectful to everybody I've worked for, and I've worked for some great people, when I look at all those people, Mark Storey, Simon Cole, Mark Radcliffe produced me at one point. I mentioned Parky earlier, and Andy and Moose at Rock. I've had some great people to work for. I hope I am the best 2 years I've ever done. I've had to learn a completely new section of the job. I've never been a journalist before. I've had to learn to be journalistic.
Producer's guidelines.
On the hoof. And I remember the very first time I was doing an interview and somebody said, challenge that. I thought, sorry? I said, you've got to challenge stuff. Oh, right, okay. Right, and I found it. It's massively exciting. I come in every day. I feel like I did when I was 33, when I started. I was quite old to start on the radio. I feel like I did then, but now I sort of know what I'm doing, whereas, of course, when I was younger, I didn't. And it's an absolute privilege. I remember Kate Squire came to see me. She's had a talk, and one or two people have put my name in the frame. Kate wanted to revolutionise the station. I know she did. And she was trying to work out how to do it and what to do. And she knew it couldn't be half a revolution. It had to be the real deal. And she'd been talking to one or two people, and my name had come up a few times. And God bless John Simmons, who used to be my boss, and he ran all the Smooth and all that stuff, all those that group, must have put my name in it. Finally, I got this call to come in and have a chat, and we were right straight away. Kate got me. And do you know something? I don't think I'd have been right coming here any earlier. It had to be that boss. It had to be Kate Squire that was there. She had to have a vision, and she's brought all this in with it, and of which I'm part of. And I'd like to think that we are the very antithesis, I think that's the right word, of a comfy pipe and slippers, tartan rug round your legs BBC local radio station. We're on it. We know what we're doing, and it's got guts, it's got commitment, and it really is part of the north of England. I mean, we're here in Media City, in the centre of Salford, broadcasting to Greater Manchester, but we're on it, and we care. Everybody cares.
And there's this thing in the industry, I suppose, about older audiences and how you've got to cater for them. But actually, being in your late 60s is the new 50s, isn't it? Because people are feeling a lot younger than they ever did. So we forget sometimes that older audience, you know, lived through the Beatles and the Stones.
Well, we were the first musical revolutionary generation. We thought we'd change the world. I listened to Bob Dylan's The Times They Had a Change, and I thought, well, that's the world changed. It wasn't, although I think we had an effect on, we have had effect on art and culture, and the world as it's viewed. And I think we were the first tolerant generation. But you're right, we are, all of us. Well, that part of me is still 18, but the oldest part of me is probably 32, 33 years of age. I mean, I still play football, still go running, still dead loud and still dead scruffy. And I wouldn't want to change our generation for the world. But there's the younger listeners that are coming on board, and there's loads of them in their late 30s, early 40s. I've had enough of, right, they don't want to listen to One Direction. They've grown out of Radio 1. Radio 2, it's all right, but maybe for them it's a little bit too comfy. They want a bit of debate. They want interviews. They want something that's not the same every day. And they do want great music as well. And suddenly here, it's coalesced at BBC Radio Manchester. that that's what we do. So we've got this whole new generation of listeners, and I can tell they're there because A, they're in touch all the time, and social media, by the way, it's the best critic ever, because if you bobbins, it'll let you know in seconds. And if they like what you're doing and they're where you're at, you can tell. There's tweets and texts, Facebook and calls every single day, almost 24 hours a day.
That could be demoralising if you were getting a lot of hate, yeah, though, I guess.
It would.
Do you see everything that comes in on your screen? Or does
everything.
It get,
and yeah, there's one or two people don't like me. For me, my greatest asset is being around 35 years. If you don't like me, you're not going to listen. You will have not listened for 20 years or more. In fact, 30, you might have not liked me on day one, so I've not listened to him. Well, now everybody knows with me, what you see is what you get. I'm no different putting the bins out or in the supermarket than I am on air. Same voice, same attitude. People trust me now. They know, actually. I remember meeting Nigel Pavaro, who's now a journalist, was on Coronation Street, and he interviewed me. He said, I owe you an apology. I said, why? He said, I thought it was all an act. He said, you're like this, aren't you? I went, yeah. He went, I'm sorry, I thought you were a professional Salfordian. I said, no. I said, I'm from Salford. He went, I really didn't realise. Everybody knows what I'm about. You know, I've been telling what I think's the truth for 35 years. I'm not going to change now. And people trust me. And that's the greatest compliment I can have. I think people trust me.
35 years, where do you go for the next 20?
I'd like to live forever, touch wood. I genuinely would love to be here in 5 years, but if you said I'll be here at 79, which I am, I'm 69 in September, if I'm fit and healthy and my voice sounds the same and I've got the same energy and the same buzz as I've had for 2 years driving in every morning, I wouldn't mind being here in 2026, as long as people want me and I'm as honest, truthful and as committed as I am now.
And there's a lot, not many people probably start a job at the BBC after they've hit pension age.
I think I've got to be the oldest person in the building. I know there are one or two older than me, just one or two in the whole of the BBC. There might be 5-10 people that are older than me. I work with people now, some of them are 20-25 years younger than me. Everybody's 15 or 20 years younger than me. It's wonderful. You're miles younger than me, Clarky, aren't you?
Yeah,
you are.
Well, I won't tell you.
No, but you are.
Your radio career is about as old as me. I was born in 80, so well, just as you
brilliant?
Were starting out.
So that, for me, is the wonder. I'm working sometimes, and I don't mean it in a pejorative way, with kids. It's brilliant because it's like playing five-a-side football with young players. You play miles better than if you're playing with your own age group,
yeah.
Miles better, because they pull an extra yard out of you. You suddenly got to work that bit harder. Well, I'm working with all these young people. I can't swan in here, put my feet up, come in at 5 minutes before the programme starts and with a I know everything. I've got to come in and say, well, teach me something new today. And you've got to be open to criticism and to comment and to advice.
And do you think life would have been different had you wound up at Radio 1 in the early 80s? How would it have gone?
It would have worked, I think, because...
Would you have been a TV star then after doing that?
But
or?
Well, who knows? But here's the thing, I'm glad I didn't, because I don't regret... I've been this thing about regretting stuff, and I probably don't regret anything at all apart from selling my vinyl records a few years ago. But I wouldn't be with... I live with the love of my life. I'm married, and we've been together 20-odd years now, Viv and I, and I adore her. And I've got beautiful kids and a great life. So I wouldn't change it. Because if I'd have gone on Radio 1, me and Viv wouldn't be together. And I wouldn't want that for the world. I'd rather be a van driver and be with her and my family than have gone on Radio 1, then on the telly and whatever, and us never have been together. It sounds dead sentimental, this. Over the last 30-odd years, people that listen to me have become my friends. I don't know them all, but I know loads of names and I bump into people. But when you bump into somebody who said, I remember listening to you when I was 6, or 7, or 17, or 20, or I wagged off school to listen to you, or I went through a bad period in my life and you helped pull me through it, or I remember, like, you know, my mum passed away and I was listening to you, and although you brought a tear to my eye, you know, I started to smile again. When you've done that to thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of people, it's priceless. Priceless.
There we are. Mike Sweeney's gone soft in his old age, you'd have thought.
Not that soft. Don't push it.
Thanks for talking to us, Mike. It's great to see you again. And all the best. It's the next 35. It's the Radio Today programme. David Lloyd's Radio Moments are on the way. First, let's get this week's news from Roy Martin.
The Radio Today programme with Broadcast Bionics.
Thank you, Stuart. Big week in radio. The daytime lineup for Virgin Radio has been announced. Edith Bowman, former Radio 1, Radio 2, 5 Live and many more stations. She's on Breakfast. That'll be good. Jamie East, he's the founder of Holy Moly website. He's on 10 till 1 mid-mornings. Kate Lawler's on afternoons. And Matt Richardson is doing Drive. Not bad for his first full-time radio gig. In fact, his first radio gig. And Tim Cocker, who is not doing radio for the first time. He's an XFM legend, of course. He's on 7-Eleven on the evenings. The station launches on March the 30th. Some of Talk Radio's schedule has also been announced. Paul Ross is on Breakfast, Julia Hartley Brewers gets Mornings, Sam Delaney's on Drive, and Ian Lee is on The Late Show. That station launches on the 21st of March, the week before. And finally this week, Dan Walker is leaving 5 Live. The afternoon presenter is off to do BBC Breakfast 3 days a week. He'll be on the red sofa replacing Bill Turnbull. That's the very latest from radiotoday.co.uk. I'm Roy Martin.
Broadcast Bionics brings you Phone Box, Oasis, Virtual Director and many more innovative solutions for creative radio people. Come to bionics.co.uk and find out more.
It's 2 years this week since LBC grew.
And, of course, a welcome to those joining us from around the UK. As you've been hearing, it's a big and exciting moment as LBC becomes Britain's first national news talk radio station. Wherever you are, you can now listen to LBC on national DAB digital radio. We will, indeed, be leading Britain's conversation.
LBC goes national this week in 2014. As the wartime propaganda raged around Europe, the BBC was keen to be heard, so a new transmitter site was identified on the east coast in the sleepy village of Otteringham. Its signal was so powerful, local residents could hear it as they picked up their phones.
Our experience with the telephones was that at certain hours, keep off, because the broadcast overpowered anyone talking on the phone. I think sometimes in English and sometimes in strange languages.
Well, the normal Dutch radio was all pro-German. People didn't want to hear that news. So they listened to the BBC and Radio Orange. If people were caught listening, they could have a penalty, 6 weeks imprisonment. But, well, you did it in your room, at home. And in the beginning, the radio was allowed, so, well, there wasn't much risk.
With a combined power of 800 kilowatts on long and medium wave, BBC Otteringham became the most powerful transmitting site in the world during World War II.
The following announcement has just been issued by Supreme Headquarters, Allied Expeditionary Force.
Happy birthday this week to Birmingham's Les Ross. He's 67, and Les recalled to Johnny Walker a competition they'd both taken part in back in their early days.
Funnily enough, the Birmingham Evening Mail organised the Disc Jockey of the Year competition.
They
1966.
Did.
We all turned up, and, well, I won in the end, didn't
you
I?
You won, well done.
I must say this now. After the final, where we were judged by the great and the good, and I won, I talked to you, it's the first time I met you, obviously, and you actually said... You probably don't remember this. You said, keep it up. You're really great.
Did I?
You did.
That was...
So thank you very much.
Happy birthday, Les Ross, TFM's first voice and many years on Breakfast in Birmingham. This week, 3 years ago, Radio 3 newsreader Patricia Hughes died. She was 90. And here she tells of a sudden awaking as she slept in the Langham Hotel where BBC presenters stayed the night.
I was woken by the telephone, but a desperate voice... You've got to come immediately, you've got to come immediately. So I hurled myself out of bed. No time to put any makeup on or put any clothes on or anything like that. By the mercy of God, I'd remembered to take a diaphanous negligee to put over my nightie, which I normally didn't ever do. I rushed down the stairs, tore across Portland Place, into Broadcasting House, and luckily with about, oh, 3 or 4 minutes to spare, got into the studio.
BBC Radio 3 on VHF and on 1215 kilohertz, 247 meters medium wave. Good morning, everyone. It's Patricia Hughes in London.
What a truly beguiling voice. Farewell, Patricia Hughes, this week in 2013. With all the news about Bauer's second network, let's remember it's 19 years since they acquired their last name.
Phil, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. I'm here.
Phil, thanks very much for taking time to join us this morning. Before we do anything else, can I ask you to launch our brand new radio station?
I certainly will. I shall name this ship, this radio station, the Big Easy, Magic 1161. Good luck to all who sail in her.
Thank you, Phil. Not sure if you can still hear us.
Yes, I can. I'm here.
Good. This week in 97, City Gold and Great Yorkshire Gold became Magic, and all those stations were in ownership flux this week, 27 years ago.
The update at 2 o'clock. I'm Joanna Hartley. It seems likely that Lancashire millionaire Owen Oyston's won his $39 million takeover bid for the Piccadilly Radio Group.
I'm very excited by it. We have a lot of exciting plans to improve the quality of radio generally. And with the help of Piccadilly and their talented people, I feel that we've made a major step forward today. So it's a watershed for radio.
The news reports from 89 and signals of early consolidation. This week in 2000, it was a farewell to Robin Scott.
The BBC's radio continuity, even on the light programme, was at times a little bit like on Radio 3. That is to say, pause, think again, decide what you're going to say, which is written down anyway, and then say it. And therefore, I was very concerned that it should be continuous.
Farewell Robin Scott, who died this week 16 years ago. He ran the light programme and presided over the split into radios 1 and 2, and he controlled BBC 2 Television 2. But even with all that, these words will be his legacy.
Stand by for switching. Get tuned to Radio 1 or 2. 5, 4, 3. Radio 2, Radio 1, go.
In the 60s, and certainly before that announcement, the pirate stations ruled, but one by one they were slain. This week in 66, Radio City fell. Its owners argued the fort was in international waters in the Thames estuary, but the court disagreed.
For me, Tom, it was for the very last time on Radio City. It's a very good night to you, ladies and gentlemen. God bless, and thank you for being a marvellous audience. Good night, and goodbye.
Farewell, Radio City. So with John Peters launching his third ever Nottingham radio station this week 13 years ago.
In the next hour, we've got some good songs from Barbara Streisand and Bobby Darin. My voice nearly went there with the excitement.
The voice of John Snagg breaking some minor news on the BBC Home Service 64 years ago.
It was announced from Sandringham that the King, who retired to rest last night in his usual health, passed peacefully away in his sleep earlier this morning.
BBC Radio London starting broadcasting in stereo 35 years ago.
Guess who's here today? Guessing with Susie Barnes.
I wonder who was. Cool FM launching 26 years ago.
We hope you will enjoy our programmes, which will feature the music and lifestyle of the 90s.
And Metro stalwart Giles Squire celebrating his 62nd birthday.
Why not join me, Giles Squire? Every afternoon on The Jowl Show.
Those are this week's Radio Moments.
Radio Moments.
Thanks, David. Thanks to Roy for this week's news and to my special guest this week, Mike Sweeney, reflecting on 3.5 decades at the top of the game we like to call radio. That's it for this week. Trevor Dan returns to the Radio Today programme after his holiday next week. And look out for Radio Today Extra later in the week. We're at a Media Society event on Tuesday night, and you can hear from guests including Paul Gambaccini, John O'Wall, the Five Live controller, and Nick Ferrari from LBC Breakfast, among others, talking to us on a special Radio Today Extra. And don't forget about In Radio, the new radio station for the radio industry. Launches Tuesday the 16th of February at 10 a.m. Radio about radio. And you'll hear me popping up on there every hour doing the Radio Today news. And from next week, the voice of the weekly news here on This Ear podcast. Thanks for listening.
The Radio Today programme with Broadcast Bionics, creating and distributing clever software for radio.